The Miniaturist tells the story of Nella Oortman, who's beginning a new life as a young married woman in the bustling city of Amsterdam in the 17th century. It is the debut novel from the author Jessie Burton, and Jessie joins us now from London. Jessie, let's begin with the story of The Miniaturist. Can you describe it in your own words?
Yeah, sure. Basically, it's set in 1686 in Amsterdam, and it tells the story of this young bride called Nella, who is 18, and she comes to the city to be married for financial reasons to a man who's twice her age, and he's a very rich merchant, but he's very distant, and the whole household she encounters is quite strange and secretive. And when he gifts to her as a belated wedding present this miniature version of their real house, and she hires the services of a miniaturist to help her furnish and decorate it, strange things start happening because the miniaturist starts sending her things that Nella believes are predicting the disasters that are unfolding in their real life. And it becomes a bit of a race against the clock to discover if she's really truly in control of her own destiny or not.
Now, what inspired you to write a novel set in the Dutch Golden Age?
It was because I was on holiday in Amsterdam in 2009, and I went to their Rijksmuseum, and that was where I saw the real Nella Oortman's cabinet house in this beautiful, it's just the most stunning decorative object. It's about 8 feet high and just beautiful kind of tortoiseshell and oak, and every single room is an exact replica of her real house. And then when I discovered that she paid the same amount for it as for a real house, into the millions really, I was immediately, my sort of storytelling antennae pricked up, and I thought, what kind of woman would buy a house she couldn't live in, or chairs she couldn't sit on, and food she couldn't eat? And what kind of society was it that either condoned or perhaps condemned such gross expenditure? And that's where it all sort of began.
So you had the kind of spark there in the real story of the real Petronella Oortman, but then you had to create your own, get your own voice for your Nella. Tell us a little bit about the young woman we meet on the pages here.
She's very confident. She's very stubborn. And she's that kind of dangerous mixture that many teenage girls have of confidence and ignorance. So she sort of ploughs into her new life. But I'm very fond of her because she doesn't ever give up. And there's a line or something, I think I say, you know, she knows she should stop asking questions because she only gets told no, but she can't help it. And she undertakes a real sort of transformation into understanding that life isn't quite white and black, and compromise is kind of inevitable. And, you know, she is the kind of beating heart of the book, but there are a couple of other characters to whom I'm very close as well.
Yes, the book is peopled by very strong characters, but the women in particular, I think, really leap off the page. For example, her sister-in-law, Maren, a fascinating character. Introduce her to us.
Sure. Maren was initially conceived as just a sort of simple obstacle, if you like, a 2D block to Nella and her adventures. But gradually, as I started writing her, I became completely fascinated and far more sympathetic towards her, because she comes across as quite repressing and sort of frustrated and obstructive. But she's very tender inside. She just doesn't show it. And she's, you know, I always say, if she was alive now, she'd probably be the CEO of a company. It's just that in the society in which she operates, she can't do that. And, you know, she has a different story of womanhood to Nella's, because she's not married and she operates on the outskirts of society, partly because of that and partly because she chooses to. So she was an interesting person who eventually started, you know, almost talking to me rather than me giving her the words.
Life inside the house is stifling, as you say, and Nella seems to spend a lot of time listening in keyholes to try and put the clues together and try and work out really what's happening in the home. But really, in a way, it just reflects outside and the social constraints outside in the society there. Maybe give us an idea of the kind of control that, say, the burgomasters had over everybody's life in Amsterdam at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a quite commonplace view that Amsterdam was incredibly liberal as it is today. But actually, although there was slight latitude towards women, they could walk out on the street unaccompanied, for example. Couples could hold hands with one another. Women, certainly working class women, worked and married later than their European counterparts. So there was a sort of sense of, like, you know, everybody's in it together. We're working, we're striving, we're keeping our Dutch nation alive. At the same time, homosexuality homosexuals would be drowned in the sea with millstones around their neck. You know, there was still a kind of Calvinist reactionary force against this great wealth that the Dutch East India Company was amassing, this great world power that it was. And the burgomasters, as long as you were rich and probably male, you know, that you would be employing your nephews and your cousins and your brothers and your fathers in all the positions of judicial power, business power and all of that. So everybody else had to sort of toe the party line. And it was very much, there was a lot of propaganda about where women belonged in the home, the domestic harmony being a microcosm of the state. And if everything was good at home and family were happy, and then the world at large would be equally happy. But they were very, they were torn between their great wealth and expenditure and ostentation, and then feeling worried and that if they were complacent, that God would smite them down again.
And reputation was crucially important.
Yes, I think there's what I found in my research was that mutual surveillance and, you know, neighbourliness kind of turning into spying was quite rife. You lived quite communally. You had to live a quite public life. And that was always going to be problematic if you had secrets or you had a personality or a lifestyle that didn't fit the mould. So reputation was important. Reputation, you know, that's what business was built on, business contacts, marriages and all of that kind of thing. There was a social contract that you had to play a role in.
And religion, again, how strong was that as a force in people's lives at the time?
That's an interesting one, because I think Amsterdam used to have a bit of a reputation amongst its the other provinces of being the sort of most loose in its morals, because it was a port city. It was probably more cosmopolitan. It was seeing lots of different nationalities and ethnicities, different religions. Obviously, it also gave shelter to those fleeing persecution. And perhaps there was more of a kind of, you know, raised eyebrow, but not going to say anything if you were trading over worrying about your God. But nevertheless, I found enough evidence to suggest that the preachers and the priests were pretty angry and still trying to be forces in the city to try and keep people under control. So, you know, God was still, and religion and attending church, that was absolutely, again, part of that social contract of being seen to worship. And some of my characters say, you know, well, we can't just read the Bible at home. We have to be seen hearing the Bible spoken in church, so everybody remembers that we're holy too.
Now, the period that you chose to set the book in demanded a lot of research. You've already referenced that along the way. But was it difficult for you, as, you know, your first time really writing a novel, was it difficult to try and just explore the narrative in the middle of the way of the research and establish your voice and make Nella leap off the page?
I think what I always try to remember, that I was telling a story first before I was delivering a history lesson. So I've always tried to avoid being didactic. I've always tried to just synthesize any historical nugget, as it were, into the plot, into the dialogue.
But how did you do that? Because, I mean, it's great to say it, but I imagine there were times you're going, this is a really interesting fact, and you're trying to shoehorn this in. You know, How did you stop yourself nearly from exploring that history lesson, presenting a history lesson?
Yeah, no, I don't know really. I mean, I think you just have to, when I researched, I did it quite through a process of osmosis. So I didn't sort of have a list of facts and go, right, Jess, you've got to make sure you get these in, because then it will seem more convincing. It was just generally an impression that I built over 4 years of a society. But for example, if I did find a recipe, I found this fantastic recipe book from 1671, and there's a maid in the book called Cornelia who basically expresses herself through cooking. And if I found a particularly juicy recipe that sounded so grotesque but fitted them perfectly, I would have her make that particular dish. But generally, I mean, it's just, you know, taking little clues, you know, where you left your greatest amount of debts, like to a tailor or to your lobster supplier and things like that, and just gradually building it up, layering, and then I suppose leaving it and then rereading and checking that you haven't overly egged the historical stuff, because, you know, you can tend to smell it a mile off when you do that. So I don't know, I think it was just through time.
The description of the book as such, you know, it sounds maybe mannered even, polite even, but it's a really sinister story. I mean, how important was it for you to evoke that creepy atmosphere that we really get from the house?
Yeah, I mean, again, I think that wasn't something I necessarily worked at. I knew that the miniaturist herself is this liminal character. But yet she's at the heart of the book. So you have to have Nella trying to work out whether this woman is working for good or evil, because obviously Nella sees things very much in dichotomies like that, because she's young and she hasn't experienced it all. So in terms of, you know, people behaving ambiguously, obliquely, things being interpreted as malign, I guess that comes from the characters themselves, you know, deciding that something is bad or something is going to be an omen. I think the weather helped, you know, it's winter, it's cold. The miniaturist herself is an elusive character. So again, both the reader and Nella, because it's all through her point of view, they are forced to make suppositions because I'm not supplying them with the evidence. So I think it was just, again, generally just not overtly trying to make it creepy, but just leaving things open to suggestion.
You're very honest in it as well about the importance of money and bartering and being good at trading and how that really was the only way to survive, regardless of what echelon society you were in. I mean, Nella comes to this marriage with nothing but her youth, really.
Yeah.
And yet she has to try and navigate this complicated world.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the characters says, you know, let's hope he loves the Gilder over God, because it was an enormous empire. Amsterdam, the Dutch Empire, stretched around the globe. They prided themselves on their great business nous. And actually, in an earlier draft, I used the word empire. And my Dutch editor said, no, that's a very British concept, empire. We were a republic and we did business. And I just thought that was very interesting, this pride still on being a good negotiator, on providing for your family, on creating a harmonious state. And yeah, in a way, if you didn't have money, you were going to suffer. And everyone, you know, was kind of on the make. There wasn't, and yet there was this kind of reactionary force about, you know, there was a lot of iconography I discovered at the time of tsunamis and waves drowning people because they'd had two massive ones in the 16th century, and they'd shored themselves up from the marshes. They had built themselves from scratch, and all the mottos in the book are from their kind of heraldry. I fight to emerge. Every woman is the architect of her own fortune. It's all about self-realization and taking destiny into your own hands. But what I was also interested in is, how far can you do that, and what do you do if you can't?
Jessie Burton has been talking to us about The Miniaturist, and it's published by Picador.